The expressed views of the guests on this podcast are theirs alone and not necessarily endorsed by the host, TWBC, or any associated sponsor. Conversations that are robust yet balanced, on point and to the point. You are listening to The Talk of Tournament Water Ski. This is the TWBC Podcast. And now, here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
Well, greetings one and all. My name is Tony Lightfoot, the aforementioned Tony Lightfoot, and this is the TWBC Podcast. Thank you very much indeed for your support. And, well, it doesn't get much better than this so far as a venue for a podcast. We're right in the middle of, well, I wouldn't say right in the middle just yet, but we are in the Straits of Gibraltar on our way on a vehicle ferry from Morocco back to Spain and onwards to Portugal, which is going to be the next water ski pro tour stop. But sitting next to me here and getting ready to kind of describe a little bit with what happened and a little bit of the behind the scenes with Monaco and Morocco, the last two water ski pro tour stops, is Vincent Stadelbauer. How are you doing?
Hey Tony, thanks for having me. All good. As you mentioned, quite a podcast location, I guess, we're having. We got about an hour and a half, I guess, to get that done. But yeah, we just left Morocco, went all the way to Spain, to end up in Portugal for the first time.
Okay, let's kind of rewind a little bit to a couple of weeks as we enjoy the view outside here in the middle of the ocean. You know, I mean, we could hurl all kinds of expletives to describe what we're seeing right now. But first off, a couple of weeks ago, Monaco, and let's talk about that, shall we? I mean, obviously, we'll get to the winners and everything, but leading up to that point, you know, how was it a relatively easy webcast to put together, or was it one of the more challenging ones?
So Monaco, funny enough, was only 10 days ago. It feels like it was a lifetime ago, but yeah. Monaco was only 10 days ago. I came to Europe on May 27th, about 10 days prior to Monaco. I landed in Italy with all the gear and made my way to Morocco to check a couple things out, and then came back to Italy and went on to Roquebrune, which is the name of the location where the event takes place. And it was a fairly smooth webcast. It's the first time that we went there and webcasted it. Unfortunately, we couldn't have you at two different places, so not having you made it a bit more challenging. That's why we had Zane and Lorenzo to come in as announcer and interviewer.
Uh-huh.
First time webcasting the event there, as I mentioned, but the venue is beautiful. I'm very good friend with Greg, which is one of the tournament organizers, also pretty good friend with Alexi, also a tournament organizer, so it always helps when we go to events that we know the event organizer. It's always a bit more friendly environment, and always definitely a bit easier for us to work in. We always need a bit of help from the organizer, or we always need a couple supplies from them. So it always helps when they help us. So it was good. It was a 3-day event. We webcasted 2 out of 3 days. Day one was amateur, and then the rest was pros. I think we did a pretty good job, and the event was definitely amazing skiing-wise.
Indeed, indeed. And this was the event that about this time last year basically took Freddie Winter out of the game for the rest of the season. So kind of commenting, you're relatively close to Freddie Winter in most tournaments. You get to chat to him, you try and get a little bit of an insight as to what he's kind of thinking, you know. So kind of what was going through your mind as far as you can see going into this event?
I think it kind of speaks for itself. It was unfortunately a season-ending crash for him last year, and he came back and podium. So he definitely got over his injury and definitely got over his fear at this event. Now leading up to the event, I'm sure he was nervous and scared, but he definitely managed to deal with it and managed to perform very good. It fought 41 twice in the final, which got him second behind Charlie. So he definitely managed to get over it. The scores of Monaco are describing that he got over it, and definitely winning Morocco this weekend, he definitely got over it.
I'm sure this is still being discussed a little bit, but there was a minimal controversy that went on with that event in the final with concerning Freddie Winter, and it had to do a little bit with SurePath and the rules that govern it. Not so much SurePath itself, which has shown itself to be a reliable piece of equipment to where it comes to making sure that every single pass at that level is fair and correct, but how it works with the rules and whether it should change or not.
So as you mentioned, yeah, SurePath is definitely something that changed the sport a lot, and only for the better. Unfortunately, Freddie in final had what's called a red boat pad, meaning the boat was outside of the tolerance. The boat is allowed to move by 49 centimeters total throughout the course. Unfortunately, at four ball, the boat was too much with Freddie on the cumulative, so it forced a runoff. The rule has already actually been redesigned originally 2 years ago. If there was a red boat path at four ball, the skier could choose to either take three and go home, or if he was going again, his score was not protected. And that was very harsh on the skier. Now the rule is already different. If the skier goes again, his score is protected of three, he cannot just improve. So the rule has already been redesigned to make it a touch easier on the skier. Is it absolutely a perfect rule? No, but I think it's the best. Unfortunately, it's the situation. There's no right rule that you can write. You can only, when you get a red boat path, it's already a bad situation. Now that's by far, I think, the fairest way also towards other competitors. That's always the way you gotta see it.
Yeah.
It's not only the skier that is being involved, but suddenly to not make it so easy that suddenly the skier that gets involved gets to beat five other guys because he had a wrong boat path. So it's definitely not an easy one to design. We definitely had a scenario at Swiss a couple of years back before those SurePath rules, when SurePath was brand new. Swiss was the first mm-hmm. tournament that had it, where there was a red boat path, meaning it helped the skier. Even with a red boat path, the skier did not manage to get into final. They made that skier ski again, and he ended up qualifying into final and kicked out three skiers. And everyone that was kicked out was saying, well, how comes he gets to go again? I didn't get to shot at it. Why he got to shot at it? The boat was helping him, and he was not already able to go through the pass. So
yeah,
it's definitely, you got to see it always both ways when you draw rules. So yeah, unfortunately, Freddie had a red boat path. He got to go again, and good for him. He managed to do 41 again and got second place.
Now,
but it's definitely a scenario that you try to avoid as a tournament organizer and as a driver, but it can always happen. I mean, driving is like a sport.
It's not perfect.
Yeah, sometimes you do good, sometimes you don't do so good. It was very windy, it was very hard to drive. Freddie's a very strong skier.
Yeah.
It's definitely not an easy one.
All right, then. So you mentioned that Freddie was runner-up. Ultimately, the win went to Charlie Ross, who's really, really coming through big time this season. I mean,
he's the skier that ran the most 41 as we talk right now.
Yeah.
Freddie went. Nate didn't run any. Will didn't run any. Freddie ran one at Lake 38, and Charlie ran two 41s this year. One at Swiss and one in Monaco. So definitely.
And on top of the fact that Charlie Ross has won Moomba Masters already this season.
Exactly, second pro win.
Yeah.
No, definitely. I think third pro win, actually. He mentioned on our interview he won some tournament in Dominican Republic. So definitely, I mean, I think we already all knew he was a very good skier. I don't think he...
Yeah, but it just...
I don't think there was anything else to prove, but definitely he showcased that he's not just good, he's very good, I guess. That's the way to describe it.
I mean, it just shows how much the mental game plays into the event, because we've all known that Charlie Ross is like, hats off, just a fantastic skier. But I mean, it's just being able to perform in those pressure situations that up until this season has been, you know, just that missing piece, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, they can all do the score. It's just who's going to do it on the day, I guess. Not all of them can do it, but quite a lot of those guys can. And definitely to do it on the day comes down to being physically ready with your equipment, but mostly mentally ready and mentally willing to attack. And they all are, and some are better at delivering it than others, but Charlie definitely that weekend delivered it in very challenging conditions with the wind on top of this.
Indeed, and not only were the men slalom skiers involved in this competition, but the women were as well. Kind of give us a summation of what you saw from the women.
But the women's field was very strong again. Ali Garcia is skiing very, very good this year. Neely, Charlie's sister, is skiing very, very good. Jamie and Ali Nicholson are definitely strong. Vanessa has been coming over to Europe for a bit longer. She was in Monaco. She was in Morocco right now. Unfortunately, she won't be in Portugal. His home site to Manon, so Manon was definitely a threat in Ogburn also for the win. So the women's field is definitely strong. And Jamie is on a streak so far, 2 out of 2.
Yeah, she's been skiing pretty well of late. And in this competition, we also had the trick skiers involved as well, in an effort to try and raise the profile of trick skiing, you know. And we're seeing the likes of Pato and Matthias, pointing out some great scores as well. But also the women weren't doing too badly themselves at Monaco.
Yeah, so we talked about it strongly leading up to this European portion of the Pro Tour. We're very happy that there is a lot of events in trick this summer in Europe. There's Monaco that had trick, Morocco that had trick, Portugal will have trick, and then the skiers will go on to Botas, which is not part of the Pro Tour, but will also have trick. So this is a bit of a first that there's 4 trick tournaments in a row. So this is something very exciting, not just for water skiing, but mostly the trickers. And in Monaco and in Morocco, we saw Pato win, which he was very eager to win. He shared many times on our camera that it was since a year he hadn't won, and he absolutely wants to win again. So it was nice to see him on top of the podium, not only in Monaco, but also in Morocco. There is a strong battle between Matti and Pato. It's a close battle. There is also Louis in Morocco and Danilo that are very close to them point-wise. And Pato took the win at the 2 events. Now we're up to Portugal. We'll see who's going to do it.
Indeed. But in between Monaco and Portugal was Morocco. Just try and give us a sense of what it was like to transition from Monaco to Morocco. They sound so much the same. You know that you have to think before you kind of speak a little bit between Monaco and Morocco. You know, so starting off with the wrap on this event. You know, I mean, it's logistically one of the most challenging things you probably have had to do in a webcast, right?
Stressful, I guess that's the way to best describe it. Very, very stressful. As tournament organizer, Camille, Isham and myself, we knew a bit what we were in for with the venue this year in Morocco. Being on a river definitely added some challenges and added some work. And the fact that I was in Monaco the weekend right before Morocco definitely added a little bit of level of stress towards me that we're a bit going to be on a time crunch. That's why I did 3 trips to Morocco prior to the event. Uh-huh. One in January to find a venue with Isham. One in March with my brother Benny and Camille in order to set up the course with Davide Gondola and Candido Motz. We went there, we set up the course, we skied on it. We noticed it was somewhat feasible, I guess. And then we took the course out, and then I came back 2 weeks ago to reinstall the course. Camille and a good friend of mine, Arno, got to stay there for 2 weeks prior to the event, kind of babysit the course, make sure everything was good leading up to the event. But for us, webcast-wise, Morocco is a stressful one because we, as you said, we're in Monaco. We had to drive over to Morocco.
How many miles would you say that was, kilometers?
So it was 1,700 kilometers, so over 1,000 miles to go from Roquebrune, which that's where we were in France, to Algeciras, which is the port town next to Gibraltar in Spain. Mm-hmm. So we drove 1,700 kilometers the Monday after Monaco. John and I, we slept at the port in Spain, and then we boarded the ferry the next morning. It's an hour and a half ferry, and then we had another 350 kilometers to do in Morocco. The trip is not necessarily that long. It does take 2 days. So when the event starts already on Friday, and on Monday morning you're in Roquebrune, there's a long way to cover before you get there. So we were eager to get there as fast as possible. As we were traveling, we received a couple bad news, so we were even more eager to get there and solve those bad news. We had, unfortunately, a crew member, Jason, that got denied entry in Morocco because of a damaged passport. He had a page torn on his passport. They sent him back to Lisbon because he had a layover in Lisbon. He had to go to the US embassy, so that took a whole 2 days. That made it stressful. On Tuesday, the course in Morocco that is located on a river that is salty, that is full of current, the salt kind of aided up a couple crimpon connectors of our course, so pretty much the whole course broke down on Tuesday. So Candido and Davide arranged for a course to come to Morocco. So there was definitely a bit of a challenges that were arising as we're trying to make our way, which was already a challenge on its own for us to go from Uruguay to Morocco. So definitely the week leading up to the event, a couple stuff needed to get done.
I think in each aspect there are kind of lessons to be learned a little bit, especially when it comes to passports and stuff like that, and making sure that the guy in Nice, France doesn't like completely destroy your passport.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, as you know, you're with us every time. We are very well organized. We are very prepared. We are, I feel, quite knowledgeable by now. But the new problem that arises, they're sometimes so out there and so out of norm, that is those things, well, there's nothing you can get ready for. You cannot get ready for an immigration officer to tear down the passport of a crew member in Nice Airport. You cannot get ready for a course to snap the Tuesday before your event, even though you build it as good as you can and you put it in already three times. And so that's why when there's time, it's less stressful. But the fact that when it's quick turnarounds, the lack of time makes it very stressful. You don't have a lot of time to solve problems. Definitely adds a level.
And I mean, it wasn't really a problem between Nice and Lisbon, which is where Jason took his original flight into Morocco. You know, it's just that whenever you fly into like an Islamic country such as Morocco, they extensively look through your passport. It's not just a cursory glance and saying, you know, that you've got a passport. I mean, when you come into Morocco, they scan that whole thing page after page after page. And if there's anything suspect in that passport, or seemingly suspect, then you're on the next flight out of there.
Yeah, pretty much. So what happened to him is he landed in Nice Airport, and when they scan his passport at immigration, they kind of fold it open like that, and he broke off the seam of the passport and a page fell off. The immigration officer just gave the passport back to Jason. Jason got into the country, didn't really think much of it, which, to be honest, between you and me,
even we if you would have shared,
we would have not think much of it. And he boarded the plane Nice to Lisbon, got to Lisbon no problem, did layover in Lisbon with the rest of the crew, a 2-hour layover, board the plane Lisbon, Morocco, Casablanca, they let him into the flight, he got to meet Casablanca immigration, and yeah, in Morocco they really swipe page after page back and forth, they check all the stamps, you travel to it a bit, they go through it, let's say, and they notice he was missing a page. They brought him to secondary inspection, he explained the story, he had no communication, they took his phone, the whole nine yards. He stayed 7 hours in secondary immigration, and they sent him on a flight back to Lisbon, because that's where he came from. So Monday night, around midnight, he finally landed back in Lisbon. Tuesday was national holiday in Portugal, so the US embassy was closed. Obviously, it needs to happen on that day. Wednesday morning, he was at the US embassy, and luckily was able to get an emergency passport right there and then, pretty much. It took him 3-4 hours, he got an emergency passport and was able to fly back to Morocco. So he was definitely a bit nervous when he landed in Morocco with his emergency passport.
Absolutely, I'd be nervous as well if the situation came about where I was in that. But I think, yeah, like I said, lesson learned, you know, just make sure you keep an eye on your passport, because you just never know in those situations. Now, the other thing was regarding the slalom course itself, you know, because the way I mean, it's a floating slalom course. I mean, it's in salty water, currents. The rise and fall of those currents, which is about somewhere between 2.5 and 2 meters from low tide to high tide.
So yeah, the slalom course we put on is kind of the only, not kind of, the only slalom course system that you can do. Is first, it's floating and not anchored because the river rises and lowers so much. Also, because there's so much current and the river is still fairly deep, the buoys would be too much all over the place. So yeah, it's kind of two big pipes and four wires that are tied down to anchor, and the whole thing floats. It adds a lot of drag, the current, definitely, on the whole system. A lot of tension on the course. But yeah, the what was very surprising is, even though all the parts were stainless steel and as beefy as they could, and that the course didn't stay that long in the water, at the end it stayed the 2 weeks before the event. It just chewed up the connectors way more than we thought it was gonna do. So when I arrived Tuesday, the whole course was broken, but not only just at one spot that you can fix, it broke at like 10-15 different spots. It was a complete mess. So we needed a new course, which is pretty much four rolls of metal wires that, luckily for us, there was one already built in Italy, not far from Tomate Gasperi's place.
Uh-huh.
So Candido arranged for someone to pick up that course, deliver it to Thomas on Tuesday. Thomas was on a flight on Wednesday for the event. So he just literally brought the course with him. That's the first time that I heard that a skier shows up to the event with a course in his bag.
Yeah.
He hand-delivered us the course. Candido arrived Wednesday around 6 p.m. in Morocco. Davide Gondola arrived Thursday at 3 a.m. in Morocco. Thursday at 5 a.m., Davide, Candido, and I, we were on a boat on the river. It took us about 5 hours to do it. Yeah, even a bit more, from, let's say, 5 to, I think we started practice around 11 a.m. It took us 6 hours to install the course. It was definitely a bit of a stressful moment. But the course was then put on, and the pro skiers could start practicing on Thursday and then go on with the event. But definitely not a scenario you wish to happen again.
All right, so course was in, river, you know, river course rising up and down, you know, in most cases there's two high tides, two low tides, and it's not the first time that we've seen a floating course. You know, the Moomba Masters in Melbourne, Australia holds an event on a yearly basis with pretty much the same kind of situation, and it was occurred in some recent times is that skiers found themselves on the losing side of their gates, you know, coming into the course, you know, so they've had to implement what is known as the Moomba rule. So kind of explain that a little bit to the best of your ability, and how that applies here to the Royal Nautique Pro.
So for the event here in Morocco, as you mentioned, what I cannot stress enough is this is very particular condition for slalom skiing. It is, there's current, there is wind, it's on the river, it's rolly. The course is built as good as it can be, but it is not perfect, meaning that with the current, the course does move. Some buoys do move while others don't. The boat path moves to the left while the turning buoys move to the right. So we definitely needed to give a bit of leeway to the skiers. Luckily for us, we're the very, very good drivers. That's what made the event possible, because you definitely gotta understand how this whole thing works when you drive the boat. But to go back to the gate rule, it's called the Moomba gate rule because Moomba started it, which is pretty much that you are allowed to hit the buoy in the gate. The normal rule of a gate, you gotta be in it, and at max you're allowed to completely run over the buoy, which is usually the right hand gate buoy that the skiers run over. This is a normal gate. If you hit the buoy on the outside, you're out of the gate, you'll be scored zero. If you don't touch the buoy, you'll be out of the gate, you'll be scored zero. Now at the Moomba gate rules, as it's called, you are allowed to hit the buoy. So if you're in the gate, you're in the gate. If you're over the buoy, you're in the gate. If you're on the outside of the gate, but your ski still hits the buoy, we consider that good. Why do we do that? Because of two things. It's challenging conditions, so the skiers are already able to be a bit less precise, but mostly the gate does move.
Yeah.
Sometimes skiers turn and say, I'm gonna be in, but because of current or wind or roller, the buoy physically moves, which we're definitely not used to that in skiing. So we implied the Moomba gate rule at the tournament.
All right then, so with that in play, the tournament started, what was it, on the Friday, and yeah, some surprising scores came out. There were one or two disappointing scores, and a couple of instances where some injuries took place. But in amongst all of that, Corey Vaughan shows up, and I mean, did he ever show up?
So definitely, overall, the score is surprising on the good end. You even heard all the skiers after round one kind of saying, well, we were thinking we weren't going to be able to run 35, but actually one of us ran 39. So round one was the best skiing conditions of the whole weekend, which was kind of good because it showed a bit to everyone the potential of this river. Corey Vaughan managed to run 10.7, 39. Got 2 at 41, was right inside of 3. All the girls ran 12, 35 off on the first round. Not all of the guys, but most of the guys, I think 12 of them or something like that, or no, maybe not 12, maybe 11 of them, something like that, ran 38 in the first round. So we saw good scores. Second round was more challenging, and final, I think second round was the most challenging.
Mm-hmm.
No, maybe final was, I think final was the most challenging. I wasn't on the water, they were, but second round and final were challenging. Second round, actually, I was surprised that the scores were actually so high also for how challenging the condition were. There was a lot of wind, but there was less current.
So I mean,
in final, we had current and wind.
So kind of describe the current in the first round where we had a Corey Vaughan score. It was, what was it, a tail current to start off with?
So we can go round by round. But overall, yeah, round number one, it was an incoming tide, I guess we could call it like that, meaning that the river was filling up.
From the ocean.
Water was coming from the ocean into the river, and the river was rising. Day two, the same, put a bit more of that, and then day three they skied earlier, so the river was empty. What we learned, well, we learned two things. The current's a big challenge, and the wind is a big challenge. This we know. Yeah. What we really learn is that if you have the current one way and the wind the other way, it makes it impossible to ski. And that's what they had a little bit in final. They had river emptying and wind coming from the ocean. So they were skiing past us tail current headwind, and they were skiing past us head current tailwind. So we learned that this is no go. It kind of creates those double chops. You kind of have the wind going over the water against the current, which kind of creates a little bit of a double up, I guess.
Yes.
So this we learned that it is not good to ski. That's literally the first note that I have on my phone for next year skiing is current and wind opposite direction, not good.
Not good.
Then the second thing we learned, to be tested, but I 100% do believe it, is that it seems to be easier to ski when the river is filling up than when the river is emptying. A couple of skiers were explaining that when the river is about to get to max low tide, that's when the river has the most force on the current, because it's true, you're getting to the narrower portion of the river, mm-hmm. so there's a lot of energy going through that river because you're riding a smaller tunnel, if you may say. When the water comes in and the river starts filling up, even though the current speed is kind of the same, just the opposite direction, apparently the forces when you ski don't feel as hard because they get a bit more diluted on the whole width of the river.
It's like holding a garden hose, you know, where you like squirting water, you know, you can put some pressure on the end, you know, the water goes, but it's the tunneling effect.
Yeah, I guess that's exactly it. Yeah, even though the current speed is the same way, there is definitely another aspect to it, which I didn't think about it before the event, which is a bit the energy in that current. If that's, I guess, I'm not a big ocean expert, but we're slowly understanding. We're slowly learning more about tide and current and forecasts and energy into the river for the past 3 months. So I think to learn from next year is try to ski when the river is filling up.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the tricky thing is that usually the low tide is in the morning and the high tide is in the afternoon. So therefore you would have to delay the start of the event, which is never something you want to do, because you start the event later, well, you're more at risk for wind and you have less hours of the day to play with. Meaning that if you start at 8, well, you have a potential, you have a 12-hour window. If you start at noon, you have only five, six, 7 hour until how late you want to run. But well, now that we kind of have got through one, if I were to make a change, I don't think it was necessarily going to be much better for the event, but overall if I could do it again, I would have made the final starts at 9 a.m. instead of at 8 a.m. on Sunday. I think the two prelims day we made the right decision. I think Sunday I was so afraid of the wind that I said we start at 8. But I think if we would have delayed by an hour, the girls would have still be rough, to be honest. The guys, I think, would have had it better, definitely, because we saw that right after, 20 minutes after Corey skied, was perfect. We saw the newcomer tournament, which were some young skiers. They ran 39, two of them ran it. So definitely the conditions were better. That said, I am very happy we did not start the tournament at 8:30 like we started the other day, because that would have created a very unfair final. Because if we would have been half an hour later, the last four skiers would have skied when those newcomers skied, and they would have been able to do much better scores than the beginning of the final. That was the whole talk of the weekend. It wasn't how the conditions are going to be. Everyone knew it was going to be rough. They all didn't know really how rough it's going to be.
They came in with expectations.
Exactly. The main thing that everyone was concerned, obviously in final, there's money on the line and points on the line. The main thing that everyone was concerned was the fairness. And when it's rough condition, it becomes very hard of fairness, because it doesn't take much to make it much better or much worse.
Yeah.
And when it's already barely skiable, that line becomes even narrower of now we cannot run 35 or now we can run 38. And we definitely saw that in the second round of the women. The couple early seeded women had it very good, and then suddenly the last three, Manon, Ali and Jamie, had it very rough. They couldn't even run 12 meter.
Yeah.
So the guys, did everyone in the men's final have the same conditions? No. Was it a fair final? In my eyes, I believe. Obviously, I wasn't on the water. Obviously, some other people are going to have other opinion. But overall, we had a fair final, I believe.
Yeah, indeed. And the final produced two really worthy champions. Jamie Ball, you know, who came through with the win in the women's slalom event. You know, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, she skied consistently well for the competition, you know, and she just let the best that she had for last when it truly counted.
Yeah, she definitely dominated the event, if we may say. She ran 39 in round one, which, I mean, that's impressive. And then scored 2 at 10.7 in final in rough condition once again. So she definitely skied well. Her physique, her style, her equipment, and her aggressivity definitely helps in scenarios like that. But she, that said, you still have to go out there and do it, and she definitely got it done.
And I mean, also, I mean, if I was to pick one other person to kind of focus on in the women's slalom, Ali Garcia, who didn't exactly have the best start in round one, she came back strong in round two and was leading for a while in the women's slalom final.
Yeah, she even said on the interview she surprised herself, and she was positioned in a turn four ball. Yeah, she got 1 at 11, I believe, in round one.
Yeah,
I think 1 at 11 again in round two. And then she got 4 at 11 in final with a very strong one, very strong four. And kind of got surprised. Very strong one and very strong three, sorry. And kind of got surprised at four. And didn't really, I mean, she said she stood up. No, she tried to turn. It's just she got there fast. It's hard to ski. She did very, very good. And then Neely went out and ran 11, and that was very, very impressive. Very, very impressive. And then kept the lead until Jamie ended up second. So definitely the two big performances in the women final were Ali and Neely.
All right. Now, before we discuss the men's slalom, let's sidetrack a little bit to the tricking event, which we had again, you know. And you mentioned Neely Ross in the slalom didn't quite have the kind of tricking performance in the final round that would feel like a Neely Ross performance. But in the women's trick final, Brooke Baldwin. You know, good to see her again. You know, she was in Monaco a week or so ago prior to that event, and good to see her back in the game after injuries and commitments to taking the MCAT and maybe getting a position in the medical field.
Yeah, definitely, it's nice to see her skiing again. It's not that she really stopped skiing, but yeah, she took a bit of time off and. She only slalomed in Monaco, and she slalomed and tricked here. And I do believe she's coming to Portugal. Probably she's going to do both in Portugal. Women's trick was a small field. There was only 3 skiers, but was a nice tournament. The guys, they were 6, I believe.
Yes, they were.
The 2 Duplan, Mati, Pato, Thibaut, Danilo. Very high score, 12,000 above scores.
Did you see much of anything from the river and the currents that kind of helped or hindered the trekking?
Yeah, it shows that they were very good at adapting. I didn't think they were going to be able to kind of trick as good as that, because I know the trickers they're picky with their speed, meaning they need to make sure they have the right pressure under their ski and they have the right wake. And And there was definitely, when you ski on current, you cannot trick your usual trick speed. You got to constantly adapt compared to the current. And I didn't get to be honest with you, I didn't get to talk much about to the tricker about the conditions, but looking at the scores, I think they were able to adapt pretty well.
All right, and that leads me straight into the final event, which is going to be the men's slalom. And there are a number of skiers in this final that really had a genuine shot of taking the win, but ultimately Freddie Winter does it once again.
Yeah, he does it once again. There were a lot of skiers, obviously, competing at the event. It was a very high-level tournament. They were all there. Final, you had to be a gladiator, really, to go out there on this river and to do the scores they did. You had to be tough, you had to be confident, and you had to be willing to take risks, yeah? to do what they do. To do what they do and to commit so much, you have to be willing to take risk, and they all did. Some went better, somewhere went worse. It was very sad to see Corey fall early into final. That was a big disappointment, but definitely very happy, obviously, for Freddie. To do it, and not only just to win, to run 39 and win. You see what I mean? It's he won, and he won with a big score. He took the risk. He went out at 12, which you kind of had to, because everyone was saying that the second pass is the tough end. It was head current tailwind, which made it harder. Yeah, made it harder, exactly. Skier seems to prefer the tail current. Tail current makes the ski kind of turn a bit more, but obviously you're down course, but head current very hard to kind of be aggressive. The nose of the ski always stays up and the tail of the ski stuck. You cannot really turn. You're trying to turn, but everything rides so high.
Everything you try to do is counterintuitive to what you know practice.
From what I kind of heard a bit through my headphones, same as people watching online, they were kind of all saying that, okay, you go out at 12, but then running 11 coming back is almost as hard as running 10-7 returning. So the 11, everyone was really focused, and we saw a lot of people unfortunately fall at 11. So yeah, Freddie went out to 12, managed to run 11 good. It didn't look like it was like a hard one. And 10-7 was the perfect intensity. He really did a lot where he needed to, didn't do much where he couldn't do much, and yeah, very, 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 very smart skiing on the 10-7 in final.
Well, as we approach the Rock of Gibraltar, over there, beautiful scenery, and tell you what, there was plenty of great scenery there at the Royal Nautique Pro, and I announced the scenery for, you know, almost ad nauseum, the Grand Theatre, the Hassan Tower, the Muhammad V mausoleum, and the Muhammad VI Tower. You know, I mean, you don't get that in a lot of tournaments.
No, definitely. Very nice. That's where the drone come into play. That was I talked to the drone operator that was there. That was the goal, was to use the drone to shoot as much of no skiing as possible. So we're getting a lot of shots of Mohammed VI Tower, which is kind of the big modern tower, the Grand Theatre of Rabat, which, as you guys saw, absolutely beautiful. We got a lot of very cool shots from kind of the surfing point by the Atlantic, kind of by the Fairmont Hotel, which we did one of the dinners.
Yeah.
Shots of the marina, shots obviously of the club, of the hotel. Definitely a venue that we're not used to.
Yeah, indeed, and I mean the scenery is only going to get better from here on in.
Already in Roquebrune was beautiful because we had the lake and the ocean right there with San Rafael right there. Uh-huh. It's already the drone shots. We had a couple of very cool drone shots where you could see kind of the lake and the ocean as the skiers were skiing. Morocco, well, completely different and more incredible. And now Portugal, I think we're going to get a lot of nice shots. I've never been to the site in Portugal that we're going.
I've never been to Portugal.
Yeah, me neither. I've never been to Portugal.
But I mean, I mean, they treated us like kings in Morocco. Seriously.
It's the luxury posh event, I guess we can say. It's definitely one that the skiers feel special, the crew felt special, the officials feel special. We have the hotel to ourselves. We walk over to the start dock. Free food, free lodging, and dinners organized every night. And it's definitely one that shows how the sport could be, I guess. It takes more money to have that at every event, but it shows
it
shows that at the end of the day, the big sport, they don't have it so bad, and do they?
No, they don't. No, I mean you can run down the list. I mean I was watching some tennis, you know, on the Eurosport German channel, you know, seeing how they do tennis, you know.
What we had this weekend is what they have every weekend,
and on the even ATP
nicer
tour.
Even nicer in even nicer hotels and but we had it good. I mean, Isham and Camille, with who I organized the event, they do a very good job at making us feel special. And when I say us, meaning the crew, the official, and all the skiers, it's definitely one of a kind treatment.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, we talked a little bit about that. I mean, you can file that under the question, what were your major takeaways from this particular event? I think you pretty much said everything there in regards to that question, unless you have something else in mind.
No, I mean, overall, we took away, for me, it was a great success. Was one of the hardest tasks that I had to do in my life, period, to be part of this event, to webcast it and to help organizing it, and what I'm the most proud of is that I got to see it through, you know, from the start to the very end of skiers dancing at the end of the event in front of the river was definitely cool to see. The goal is to do it again next year. That's the goal, to do it every year, to do it bigger, better, and crazier every year.
All right, as we approach British territorial waters, we're right underneath the shadow of Gibraltar, but that's not where we'll be disembarking. We'll be disembarking at what is it? Al Jazeera?
Algeciras, yes.
Algeciras, yes.
Spain.
Yeah. Okay. So
we gotta get ourselves into Europe. We gotta get ourselves into Spain, and we gotta get our gear into Spain. There's going to be, how many checkpoints do you think we're going to go through? We went through about freaking 50 checkpoints.
Yeah,
that was
I don't know what the heck was behind all of that.
I mean, we're changing continent with
we had a van scan twice.
Yeah, we're exchanging continent with an Italian. We have a British passport, a Swiss passport,
and an American passport,
an Italian rental van, and a lot of cameras and cable that are a bit valuable, so it's definitely not an easy one to go through. What people might wonder, Tony, is why do we drive and not fly?
Don't tell me about flying with this equipment. I mean, it is just remarkable. I mean, we have how many cases? Like 23 or so cases?
Yeah, we have 26. We have about, let's see. So if I put in kilo, we have about 2,000 pounds worth of equipment. Well, the equipment, the announcer, there's the tent. It's impossible to fly. We fly, obviously, over from the U.S. With United Airlines, because they do us a discount. They allow us, first of all, to take so many bags. We have a good bag discount, so we're able to afford bringing all the cases. But also when we arrive here in Europe, now, year after year, we've been building a little bit of equipment that stays. We have stuff always waiting for us in Italy. Extension cord, announcer desk, tent, tables, stuff like that. So driving is the only way. We load everything in a minivan and we drive from places to places. Obviously, going to Morocco by car makes it a bit more extreme.
Yeah,
but,
indeed.
But it's working so far. And we're going to get ourselves into Spain and then we'll be doing pretty good.
And with that, that would be an opportune time to jump off here on the TWBC podcast. Before we shut this down and put a bow on this episode, anything else you want to say at this point?
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And stay tuned. Portugal coming up this weekend, and in 2 weeks, San Gervasio.
And that concludes this episode of the TWBC podcast. So we've had some great times so far, and look forward to the next episode probably coming to us from Portugal. But in the meantime, it is ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC podcast.